Thank you very much, Asaf, and thank you for inviting me. It's a privilege to join with all of you today. As Asaf mentioned, my area of research focuses on organized Jewish life in the United States. I am not per se involved in research on the Middle East and issues of that sort. So I'd like to talk about domestic American Jewish life, although I will be getting to the of Israel somewhat later on in the course of my discussion. So as Asaf mentioned, after COVID began, which is almost a year ago, 11 months ago, I had plans to do research on a totally different project. But since getting into research institutions, not the easiest thing in the world during COVID, I switched my focus. And I've been looking at the impact of this crisis, the pandemic crisis, on different sectors of American Jewish life, on communal organizations, on synagogues, Jewish organization. I've written about all three, and now I'm actually turning my attention to a fourth area, which is Jewish philanthropy. And I'd like to give you an overview of what it is that I've been finding, and perhaps in a concise fashion, tell you essentially what my thesis is going to be today, and then we'll take it from there. Simply put, when the COVID crisis began, there was a great deal of hand-wringing, or pseudo-hand-wringing, which I'll explain a little bit later, on the part of observers, many observers of American Jewish life, that, to quote one of them, the COVID epidemic is going to put the final nail in the coffin of organized American Jewish life, meaning that Jewish organizations are doomed to collapse during the course of this crisis. And after doing research on this, speaking with a couple of hundred people around the country about different sectors of the Jewish community, what I have found is that there is very little truth to that. It didn't materialize. The fear that they expressed did not materialize. And in fact, Jewish organizational life, with some noteworthy exceptions that I will touch upon, has pivoted is doing relatively well given all the givens. That having been said, there are other areas of American Jewish life that are a cause of concern, that were really not on the radar of those who wrote early on and continue to write, by the way, about the impact of COVID. And so I want to touch upon both of these two aspects. What has happened to the major institutions of American Jewish life that serve American Jews and to some extent serve the wider population also, on the one hand, and on the other hand, have there been some negative effects on Jewish life that perhaps have not been on the radar screen of many observers? So to begin with the first point, as I noted, there was an expectation by some that this would be the final nail in the coffin. And I stress that point because the predictions of doom for organized Jewish life have been in the air, if you will, now for roughly two decades, since the beginning of this century. And the predictions essentially said that the major organizations, often referred to, by the way, as legacy institutions of the American Jewish community, such as federations of Jewish philanthropy, the major national Jewish organizations, the Anti-Defamation League, the American Jewish Committee, many local Jewish agencies, synagogues, these were all deemed to be 20th century institutions, largely founded during the first half of the 20th century, and certainly in the 21st century, it was argued, they really don't have any future. They don't offer any appeal. Now, that was not based just on fantasy. The reality is that survey research has shown now for the last number of decades that there has been a decline in membership organizations, Jewish membership organizations, a steep decline in the numbers of Jews who claim in surveys that they give to the campaigns of Jewish federations of philanthropy, and for that matter, give to Jewish causes at all. So these fears that were expressed, and I would argue in some cases wishful thinking by some who were interested in seeing other types of institutions emerge, certainly were not based on a total fantasy. There is a reality out there. But that having been said, once the COVID pandemic struck, then it was assumed that these institutions were finished. And not only that, but that these institutions were so busy competing with one another in a zero-sum game that they couldn't possibly work together at a time of crisis. Fears, those concerns, those wishes, in some cases, have not materialized from everything that I've been able to see. This period of time actually has been one in which these legacy organizations have been revived, have drawn fresh attention, and frankly, are now seen, at least for the short term, as necessary institutions, essential institutions, without which the American Jewish community cannot function. I'm talking now about average Jews who see it this way, and perhaps equally important or more important, funders see it this way. The Jewish Federations of North America, which is the umbrella organization of the Federation movement, has played a major role in gathering information and then disseminating that information about various government programs, most notably the PPP, the Payroll Protection Program, which has channeled huge sums of money to Jewish institutions of all sorts, and not only Jewish ones, because I heard reports about many non-sectarian organizations that also benefited from the information that was provided by the Jewish Federations of North America and from other federations. There was a lot of cooperation, in other words, between Jewish and non-Jewish or non-sectarian organizations in local communities about how to gain access to government funding. And that certainly has helped these institutions get through the past 11 months. But in addition to that, from what I've heard, certainly through the last fiscal year, which ended as of July 1st of 2020, the various campaigns of federations, of national organizations and the like were robust. There were funders who stepped up, who made up for shortfalls in some areas, and those institutions have continued to function. In some cases, they've had to reallocate some of their resources and personnel, by the way. And in some cases, of course, they did have to let people go. Hardest hit during this period of time were the Jewish community centers, many of which were not able to open for a long time. And then when they've opened, they've only been able to do so on a very limited basis. These are institutions that rely heavily upon fee for services, and they've been hard hit. Jewish summer camping, which residential camping especially, was hard hit last summer. They were not able to open. It's not at all clear that they're going to be able to open this coming summer. But even there, there were philanthropists who stepped up and provided funding to help tide these camps over because they valued them. And the same has been true of synagogues. There are some synagogues that are struggling, but from all reports that I've gotten, and I've spoken with people in all of the religious movements about this, there are very few synagogues that have gone under so far. There are some that are teetering, and we'll have to see what happens. There is some talk about some mergers, which may not be a catastrophe at all, may be beneficial. There too, funders have stepped up to ensure that these institutions can continue their work. Now, the purpose of these institutions is not just to survive, but to provide services. And that's what they've been doing. Among those services, or most certainly most significantly, they have provided various kinds of human services support for those who have lost jobs, for those who've been furloughed, for those who have difficulty putting food on the table, for those who have difficulty paying their rent. These organizations, federations, for example, local agencies, synagogues have provided support for Jews in need, and in many cases for the wider population in their communities as well. Federations have continued to do something that a few of them actually began doing during the Great Recession, and that is to channel some funds to rabbis of synagogues so that individuals who were embarrassed to seek aid from some of the major communal service organizations could do so anonymously, the rabbis of synagogues were given funds to distribute to them. And then when it comes to other types of functions, synagogues have continued to provide religious services. The high holidays were online in various ways. In some cases, especially in Orthodox synagogues, they were in person, but synagogues found ways to provide those religious services, sometimes in very socially distanced in a very socially distanced fashion within synagogue buildings, when the weather permitted, at outdoor minyanim, prayer services. That was certainly the case with Orthodox synagogues, as well as with a fair number of conservative synagogues. And then when it comes to education, there has been an explosion in adult education programming on topics of all sorts, of all types of topics of Jewish nature and other types of topics too. We don't have precise numbers of the actual populations attending these sessions, but by all reports, synagogues have reported dramatic increases in the numbers of people attending religious services, and certainly also attending various lectures and other types of programs that they have offered. And then when it comes to the question of schooling, a point that I'll be speaking more about very shortly, the additional issue is that many day schools have been able to open for study. Sometimes it's several days a week for each grade. In some cases, it's 5 days a week. In some cases, it's 3 weeks in person and 1 week not in person in order to clean the building properly. But day schools have, in most cases, except for those states that have been the harshest in shutting down, such as California, have been able to do in-person study, and they have pivoted well also to Zoom learning. So much so that enrollments in many, certainly not all, non-Orthodox day schools has increased during COVID because day schools, for a variety of reasons, have been able to do much better than public schools. And all of this then has led to what I believe is a renewed appreciation for institutions that in the past were maligned, were looked down upon, were seen as being yesterday's news, but in fact have demonstrated a certain ability to be nimble and certainly to care for their constituents. And I want to reiterate that point, or elaborate rather on that point, by saying that a great deal of attention is being paid by synagogues, by formal educational institutions as well as informal ones such as youth movements, Jewish youth movements, that is, to the emotional well-being of young people. Perhaps more so that than anything else, which I think is somewhat problematic, as you will shortly hear. So having said all that, then, if everything is so terrific, are there no problems still out there? And I certainly want to note several areas that do concern me deeply that I haven't really read much about, but I'd like to bring to your attention. Let me start with a topic that I know is close to the hearts of many of you who are listening, and that has to do with the whole question of Israel. Obviously, what has happened during COVID is that all kinds of trips to Israel that normally would have gone have been canceled. There are Jewish day schools that usually reward their graduates, both in middle school as well as in high school, with trips to Israel. Those have been canceled. There are programs that are sponsored by the major youth organizations of the Orthodox and the conservative and reform movements. All of those have to be canceled. That's also true, of course, of Birthright Israel, where trips have not been mounted. And that means that we have a very significant population of younger Jews who have not had the opportunity to go. Birthright may very well be able to catch up once the COVID crisis passes, but we're not sure when that's going to be, clearly. But in the meantime, much has been lost in that area. And then to make matters even more complex, some of the programs of informal Jewish education that have played an important role in teaching young people about Israel and connecting them emotionally to Israel, such as the programs of the various youth movements, such as religious schools, which devote some of their time to talking about Israel. They have not been focusing nearly as much, if at all, on Israel this year, given the other preoccupations. And so we're talking about a generation that, at least for a year, and this may stretch on longer, has been deprived of opportunities to learn about Israel. And that certainly is something that I am concerned about. And then to touch upon an area that I'm sure is close to your hearts, there's the whole question of students on American college campuses. I will say cynically, and I'd love to hear some of you react to this, that the fact that many campuses are not providing in-person learning, but Zoom learning, and that on many campuses, students are not able to live on campus, may be a good thing in the sense of shielding younger Jews from some of the political theater and frankly, blatant anti-Semitism that they encounter on some campuses. That's something that you know more about than I do, although I will tell you that I'm a professor at JTS, as you heard, so I live in a pretty sheltered environment, but all of our undergraduates are in a joint or a dual degree program with Columbia and Barnard, I've heard in classes from students about some of the things they encounter. I don't want to magnify this and say that that's all they encounter on campus, but I've heard about unpleasant experiences that some students have had on campus. So what I wonder about is whether, in fact, they're not being on campus has been a plus for them. What I also worry about when it comes to education is whether, with all the goodwill and all the pivoting and all the investment in providing high quality Zoom education, whether students, I'm talking now about students enrolled in Jewish educational programs, are getting the kind of, what shall I say, academic quality, serious learning that they would have prior to COVID. As I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of emphasis upon providing emotional support at this time. And I understand that, and I value that. But what we don't really know is the extent to which students have fallen behind over the course of this year. And I say that we don't know that because I'm not sure just how much assessment is taking place, how much testing is going on, and standardized testing. I'm talking about both in terms of general literacy as well as Jewish literacy. And those are areas then that are of concern to me, and that we're going to have to pay attention to once this crisis passes. The last item that I'll mention before concluding is the whole question of priorities that I've heard about from a number of educational programs. We have lived through, certainly last summer and stretching beyond that, the Black Lives Matters movement and all the to-do surrounding systemic racism. And to my dismay, what I've learned is that a number of Jewish educational institutions have jumped on that bandwagon and focused heavily in their programming upon the whole question of racism. I will add that the topic is not an irrelevant topic, and it's not one that Jews should ignore. But at the same time, I have been concerned over the years about what all the emphasis on white privilege and the attendant propaganda that surrounds it has been doing to the morale of Jewish students. I say that as a teacher who in his classrooms every semester encounters at least one student who gives me the truth about white privilege, which very much, according to those students, includes Jews. My concern is that that's being reinforced crazily enough by some Jewish educational institutions, especially those involved in informal education. So there are a variety of issues that are, if you will, beneath the surface, currently beneath the surface at least, that have not been attended to from what I've been able to read in terms of Jewish life, that do concern me far more than the health and stability of Jewish organizations. And with that, I'm more than eager to engage with you.
Wonderful, wonderful, Jack. Thank you for that. Very important unpacking of these critical issues that we're facing in the Jewish community today. And so, obviously, a lot to talk about. Questions have been coming in as you've been talking. So people are indeed very interested, and there's a lot to tackle. I guess before we go on to the audience's question, Alex, let me give you the prerogative to start us off, and we'll take it from there.
Sure, I have lots of questions, and I'll echo my thanks as well. For a reassuring kind of scenario, or mostly reassuring scenario that you've laid out, and I think my question is with respect to schools and involvement with communal organizations, and with respect to the bottom line. Do you have a prediction about whether this will last?
Okay. You said you have a number of questions, but you want to leave it at that, Alex?
I'll leave it at that, because there are lots of people want to put their two cents in. So my question is really, when all of this virus stuff is over, do you think it'll last?
Right. So I like to say to my students that that's a $64,000 question, but of course they have no idea what I'm talking about. But you do, Alex. That is the great question, and certainly it's one that has been echoed as I've interviewed personnel, the top leadership of major organizations of all kinds. They don't know how whether this will last, and the likelihood is that some of this glow that now attaches to some of these legacy organizations probably will diminish. One of the people I interviewed told me that people look upon federations, as an example, you know, as the local firehouse. They want to know that it's there, but when they don't need it, they really don't pay much attention to it. That's kind of the negative side of this. Once the crisis passes, some of these institutions may get forgotten. On the other hand, there is also reason to think that they've proven their mettle, and that may mean that their supporters are going to continue to provide support. There's a whole separate issue here, which has nothing to do with COVID, but began much earlier, and that is whether younger Jews will wish to support these institutions. Many of these institutions rely heavily upon funding from baby boomers and those who are older. Will the Gen Xers, will the millennials want to support them? As rates of intermarriage have skyrocketed, will the giving priorities of families that have significant assets, will they change? Those have been questions that have been on the table now, at least for the last quarter century, and we don't know the answer to that. So basically, I've given you a hedged answer because, Alex, I'm a historian and I don't do well at prophecy.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Okay.
All good. Alex, do you want to have a follow up or should we go to the audience?
No, let's move along.
Okay. Jack, there are a lot of questions, but let me try to go through them and go from there. So our friend Jerome Dennis is asking, which Jewish organizations are actually helping build their immune system so that any virus ensnares them will have a mild case? The low bar he's giving an example is that England is now sending bottles of vitamin D to all at-risk people. So if you want to comment on that.
The short answer is, I don't know. It's not something that I've really encountered. It's an interesting question, but I just don't know.
Okay, fair enough. Let's go on to Hal. Hal has a few questions. Hal Bass, he's asking, are there parts of the U.S. where Jewish institutional life is more vigorous than other parts? Maybe you want to talk about the geographical kind of fragmentation, talking about federations and whatnot, being the firehouse. Are there differences I'm adding here between East Coast, West Coast, Midwest that you've been able to observe in that regard?
Okay. What I'm wondering is, do you want to lump a couple of questions together, or do you want me to go one?
Yeah. Let me add more in that regard. You know, he's continuing. How he's also asking. You know, he's asking about the Jewish day schools. How prevalent has COVID been? You know, you've mentioned a little bit about that. Maybe you want to expand among students and staff in Jewish day schools. You said you made a comment. I know in your remarks the difference between Jewish day schools and public schools. You may want to expand on that. So why don't we take those two aspects and then we'll move on to the next.
Okay, fair enough. From what I've been able to learn, I don't know that we can say that there are major geographic differences in terms of the kind of the fiscal health of various Jewish organizations. Certainly, there are parts of the country that have been hard hit and where the closures, the lockdowns, whatever you want to call them, have been far more draconian. That's obviously the case in California, especially in Los Angeles, so that the day schools there have been required to close down and synagogues have been required to close down. And by contrast, in other parts of the country, especially in places like Florida, which has had a much more latitudinarian approach to this, there have been many more possibilities for schools to be open and for synagogues to have services, albeit distanced, socially distanced services and the like. So what I'm trying to say here is that geography in the sense of weather, different tiers of the country, and also the impact of the resurgence of this virus in different parts of the country have affected how Jewish institutions have been able to function. But from a dollar and cents point of view, there's a different dynamic at work, and that is not related to COVID. We've known for decades now that in some parts of the country, there are much stronger cultures of giving. That's most evident in Midwestern cities, and it's not unique to Jews. Although Jews are quite active in giving into causes in Chicago, in Cleveland, in Detroit, where the cultures of giving have been very strong. And in places like Los Angeles, as the culture of giving, especially by wealthy people, is not strong at all. Some of it has to do with the transplanted, the nature of the transplant. There's a lovely metaphor in Robert Putnam's book, Bowling Alone, in which he talks about populations and their involvement with civic life, which was his area of interest, being very much related to, or analogous rather, to transplanting a plant in a new pot, and how it takes time for that plant to send roots through the soil in the new pot. And the analogy is, as Jews have moved to different parts of the country, it has taken time, in some cases generations, for them to feel that this is home and I want to invest my money here. That having been said, I heard, for example, that in places like Dallas and in some places in Colorado, there are Jews who have moved there who are intent on creating strong Jewish communal institutions. I'm not talking necessarily about religious ones, but JCCs, for example, in order to provide an anchor for Jewish life. So what I'm trying to say is that there are a number of variables at work here. Some of them are directly COVID-related. Some of them have to do with region, which is a very important variable, that didn't stem from COVID per se. As to day schools, something very similar. There are parts of the country where day schools have been able to open, especially for in-person learning, especially where the climate is more temperate. Some day schools have invested very significant sums of money to build on their grounds to provide so-called pods for students. And the purpose of all that is to separate, isolate groups of students, i.e. pods of students, so that if in fact a student or a family member of a student is infected with COVID, then the whole school doesn't have to close down, but rather students in that pod have to quarantine for a week or 10 days or something like that, and then they can resume again. And that's happened quite frequently, unfortunately, on campuses. It so happens that over the weekend I was speaking with a friend who has a child attending a Jewish day school, and the day that child attends 3 days a week, but for one reason or another has not been present in the school on a Monday all year long, because there's always some kind of issue that comes up. So it's not as if day schools are immune from this, but they have found, in general, they have found ways to engage students in hybrid learning, which is defined as sometimes in person, sometimes on Zoom. And when it's on Zoom, they also engage in what now is called concurrent learning, which means that some students are in the classroom and some students, for a variety of reasons, who can't come in person, are able to participate via Zoom in that same classroom or participate with that same classroom.
Thank you for that. Let me ask a question. You know, actually, you know, I know I have kids in Jewish day school, so I guess a personal question, you know, at large is a kind of a follow-up, Jack. And obviously they've been able to accommodate, we know that, and that's great, you know, as far as the socialization and whatnot. Have you looked into the, you know, the quality as far as, you know, are we able to look at, are we seeing any of that? I mean, is, you know, some of us have been concerned that this year is, you know, not effective because we're not able to have the ongoing engagement. Some Jewish day schools, we've been able to have that, you know, hybrid modality. But are we also looking at the, you know, you mentioned early on about the lack of the Israel part. Are we also missing a lot with the, you know, with the in-person experience as far as what Jewish education is providing, or do we think that, you know, the Zoom platform and everything online has been able to compensate for that, and they're still getting the same kind of quality we would like them to achieve? Is that something that you looked at in your research?
To an extent, and again, it's hard to look at that other than to interview people in schools. And the flip side of that is interviewing parents and what their impressions are. But I alluded to this matter, and I'm glad you raised it again, because it's an issue that's not confined to day schools and it's not confined to Jewish education. It's across the board in education, and certainly there has been a lot written already in the field of general education about what has been gained and what has been lost. The point I was trying to make is that when it comes to pivoting to Zoom classes, and I'll add now to that, utilizing online resources and curricula, day schools did it quickly, in some cases literally overnight, in other cases took a day or two. I'm talking now about last March and last spring, and they've continued to build upon that. They've also worked hard at trying to create opportunities for children to interact with each other, which is why they've been so intent on opening for in-class meetings if at all possible. But the area of concern that you're raising is my concern as well, and that is how effective has the actual educational experience been, and the Zoom really do it. I'm going to use my own experience here, and that is in my own classes on Zoom, I can see that there are some students who seem to be on top of the material and are interacting and are submitting their work in a timely fashion and so on. And in every class, there is a student or two who seems lost. And I'm talking now about college students, undergraduates. And I'm sure that the situation is even more extreme in younger grades. And the younger the grade, the more difficult this online learning is. I believe that students are losing out. And by the way, this is especially true or equally true of schools in of children rather enrolled in religious schools that are sponsored by synagogues or in other types of settings, where again this online learning is focuses very much on connecting with students, trying to break down their sense of isolation, and the actual subject matter is secondary, if not tertiary. And we're going to have to see what price will be paid for that.
Thank you. No, obviously there's a lot. There's we don't know the cost benefit analysis and what, you know, the what kind of benefits we're going to reap yet. But obviously that's all evolving on an ongoing basis. Let me move on to, you know, I know we just to kind of get also get some of our audience's questions in as well. Arnold Schwartz is asking in particular about the Haredi experience or relative neglect regarding COVID-19, both here and in Israel, affected Jewish community relations with the larger Jewish communities and, you know, how they've been operating as far as municipal relations, government support, and in general, collaborative issues. Have you looked at those, you know, at what's going on in the Haredi communities as well in comparison to other sectors of the Jewish community?
I have not, in part because access to the Haredi community is so difficult. But it's not as if I've been oblivious of it, and I'd be very happy to respond briefly to this. It's no secret. There's been a goodly amount of press coverage, both in this country as well as in Israel, and there's been a good deal of public statements issued by government leaders, both in this country as well as in Israel, about the reality that many of the Haredi communities have not been following government issued guidelines. And they are not engaged in social distancing and wearing masks. And there have been critics from within their community who've been really quite firm about this, but it has not really made all that much of a dent. There are complicated reasons why Haredi Jews are behaving this way. Some of it has to do with attitudes towards the government, which are deeply ingrained in Haredi life, where governments are seen as untrustworthy and at best to be worked around. But more important, I think, is that Haredi Jewish life cannot function, cannot exist in its usual form through social distancing and without people gathering together closely and for prayer, for learning. It just doesn't work for them. And they've made the calculated decision that they are, as a community, better off taking their chances than following these guidelines. Now, we may think that this is crazy, but from using the calculus of their own, which is that keeping their communities tightly together is the most important thing, it makes sense to them. But coming to this other part of the question, the relationship with the wider Jewish community, unfortunately, I fear that this is going to create or has created already a greater chasm between Orthodox Jews and non-Orthodox Jews to begin with. But it's also creating more of a chasm potentially between modern Orthodox Jews who are appalled at this behavior and the Haredi community. So there will be future reverberations to this, and we don't know how that's going to play out. You know, and of course, we know the Haredi community tries to be insular, so this may play into their hands if they are shunned. I don't mean in a formal sense, but if they are treated as whatever it is, as pariahs. So this is not good for the Jews from my point of view.
Great, thank you. I'll move on to another question here that we have. Apropos the Orthodox community, I guess another question that came in on that, there is, you know, there's a whole rumor about the anti-vaccine, you know, the anti-vaccination myth about impaired fertility, and particularly targeting the ultra-Orthodox community. I mean, is that something that you've seen that's also played into all of this? I know you haven't looked at it that much, but are those kind of conspiratorial theories or things like that, you know, playing into the conversation about the collaboration of the Orthodox community and the need for the vaccination?
I know about this through what I read in the media, right. Among the things I have read is that, to take one example that was just in the news within the last week, there was a Chabad rabbi in Massachusetts, I believe, who was propagating these myths about the vaccine, and the Chabad movement banished him. And again, let's be very careful to distinguish between the modern Orthodox community, where Orthodox synagogues have been, from everything I've heard, modern Orthodox synagogues have been super careful about following government guidelines and protecting their people, and the Haredi world. And here too, this is a generic term that covers a lot of territory. Technically, Chabad is part of the Haredi world, the formal attitude of Chabad is much more much more concerned about following the health guidelines than some of the other Hasidic groups are. Again, the reason I said before I don't think this is good for the Jews is because Jews tend to stereotype each other. And I fear that stereotypes about that sector of the community are coming to us very cheaply, and are just not very helpful to us.
Great, thank you, Alex. Let me turn it back to you as far as another question for Jack.
Sure. Let me go back to something you said early at the outset regarding, predictions of doom that had been made and have been made for many years, for a couple of decades, regarding communal institutions. And I'm always curious I've always been curious about these predictions, some of which are based on empirical data and some of which are based on wishful thinking. And in this particular context, the context of this year, as well as the broader perspective, who benefits from these predictions of doom, and why have they become so prevalent?
That's a great question, which I've been grappling with on my own in recent years. Look, I mean, one can respond to this in a more generous fashion by saying, look, the short answer is who benefits from this? It's people who are creating startups. They are dismissive of existing institutions because they feel that their startups are much more relevant and meaningful, especially to their age peers. And, why is it that these legacy institutions are attracting the philanthropic dollars, the important funding, and why are they the startups struggling? To some extent, we're talking about a kind of generational tug of war, which is not new. It existed in the past in many different settings. Most recently, or what comes to mind, is the emergence of the Chavura movement in the 1970s. Where these were younger people, my age peers actually, who organized these chavurot or fellowships, and they gathered together and they were very critical of existing institutions as being too stodgy and outdated and so on. There was something to what they had to say. And more important, the models that they created were quite beneficial for the wider Jewish community, so much so that their ideas were adapted. And the same thing has been happening in this century, where younger people, especially Gen Xers, created a whole variety of startups, of new institutions for all kinds of purposes, for Tikkun Olam purposes, for religious worship or religious congregating that are not conventional synagogues, Moishi houses, all kinds of different settings for the gathering of millennials and Gen Xers. And some of the ideas that they have put forward have enriched the American Jewish community and have been borrowed or adapted by existing institutions. And there's a mythology that developed, and I believe it was intentionally developed, that it's only the startups that understand the reality of American Jewish life. Well, the truth of the matter is that these legacy institutions, most of them at least, have tried to adapt and have sponsored innovation and have funded many of these startup organizations because they're not the stodgy, unchanging opponents of innovation that they're charged with being. So again, there's a kind of generational struggle that's at work. But that having been said, there's also something else that's going on, and that is we're living in a time also where there's a growing clamor by some younger Jews who, and maybe younger isn't the right word, but some Jews on the left who want to tear down the existing institutions and certainly tear down the Jewish philanthropic system because they are in favor of much greater government involvement as opposed to the vitality of what's often referred to, after all, as the independent sector. That's what the philanthropic sector calls itself, the independent sector. It's a mediating institution between the government and between local institutions. So there's an ideological agenda at work also. And quite frankly, some of it also has to do with a deliberate attempt to try to weaken organizations that take a, what shall I say, a more hawkish position on the Israel-Palestinian conflict. So there are a variety of factors at work here, but we would be foolish not to recognize that there is an ideological element to this story, too.
Great, thank you, Alex. A follow up to that, or move on to another question.
Let's move on. I don't want to monopolize unfairly.
Okay. May I ask a question? Because I'm really curious about my question, answers to a question of my own, and I don't know if this will work. But I've said that I live in a pretty much of a bubble because I teach at a Jewish institution, and while there's no question that some of the students I encounter have been affected by the kinds of stuff that they're hearing on campuses. And I'm not talking about criticism of this Israeli policy or that Israeli policy. I'm a believer in freedom of speech, but rather the hostility towards Israel and singling out Israel, and frankly, the anti-Semitism. And I've made mention of that. And I'm wondering whether any of the listeners would care to comment on how that has played out from what they've noticed during COVID, because I don't know the answer to that question.
That's a topic that, of course, you know, Alex and I live and breathe all day long. Maybe Alex, you want to tackle that, the answer to that. I'm not sure that we'll have enough time for people to type in their questions here, but maybe you want to answer Jack's question.
I'll offer some general observations. The first being that anti-Semitism never goes away. The BDS movement never goes away, and that the media or the vectors for these kinds of movements and sentiments has adapted in the past year, that when classes went online in March and April last year, there were many, many incidents at really all levels, not simply colleges and universities, but K through 12, of Zoom bombing, where anti-Semites from various parts would interrupt classes with all sorts of screeds and statements until Zoom improved its security measures and made it harder for people to kind of interrupt out of nowhere. Student governments at universities have obviously been a big source of problems with respect to BDS resolutions, yeah, and referenda and things like that, and they all took their meetings online as of last spring and remain online. And the number of these BDS resolutions and referenda, I don't know. It varies from year to year, according to some other rather more cosmic kind of conditions, but they're still there, and they're still being proposed and debated, sometimes at length, someplace in the fall, and I'm blanking out where. You know, a 7-hour Zoom meeting where they're going back and forth about BDS and divestment and so on.
I know it's Columbia too.
Yeah, and Columbia approved a resolution in the fall.
Yes.
So,
yes.
You know, the campus environment is not, or is only now beginning to be, a face-to-face one again. Haltingly and partially. We just took our daughter back to college on Friday, and she's in quarantine for a week, seeing only her suite mates. So that is, she is gradually emerging from the chrysalis of the past year. And of course, we don't know, although we do sort of know, what goes on in classrooms with respect to anti-Israel sentiment and the general tenor of how the general tenor of things where anti-Israel, anti-Zionist, anti-Semitic pedagogy and ideology has very much been merged, especially in the last year or more, with movements about anti-racism and Black Lives Matter, and now anti-whiteness and anti-privilege.
Yes.
So these things never go away, and they'll just change their tones and change their tunes. Everybody's had a hard time in the last year getting their messages across, for good and for ill. And I think that once everyone can speak face-to-face and exist face-to-face, we'll be back where we were in whatever different way it will be the style and tenor of the moment. But
understood.
In terms of overall quantity, it's probably fair to say it's down, along with all sorts of quantities of things, but it's there.
Thanks.
Yeah, the when we're cynics, we're not concerned about what we're going to do with ourselves. You know, there's the work continues, and the challenges are only continuing to grow all around. I mean, we're seeing it, we're hearing it on both ends, faculty and on student side. So there is no shortage of things to do. The only thing that we are seeing, of course, is the growth of what we've seen in North America is that kind of tension between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism, and people trying to make the argument on the opposition that anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitic, though we all know it is, and the way it manifests itself. And there's a whole debate now vis-a-vis the IRA definition that is now playing out into trying to implement that on college campuses to make, to enforce what is anti-Semitic acts when they are happening, but you get the administration to do something about that.
Yes.
Unfortunately, you know, gentlemen, our time is up, and you know, obviously, you know, there's a lot to talk about, but we still have more questions coming in, but you know, we did not get to them. So I apologize to the audience for not getting to all the questions. And again, please feel free to email us at bdsmonitor@sbme.org. Jack, I want to take again, you know, I want to thank you again for taking the time to join us this afternoon, and hope you can come back at some other later point when there are more developments to talk about. Alex, I want to thank you as always. And of course, above all, I want to thank the audience for taking the time to join us as always. I hope everybody is staying safe and healthy, and we will continue the conversation and be on the lookout for more webinars to come. So Jack, thanks again. And we look forward to
pleasure. Thanks for the invitation. Take care.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks very much then. Take care.
Bye-bye.